Welcome to the Givergy podcast. I'm Ben, Givergy's COO. And for those of you who don't know who we are, we're fundraising experts who provide fundraising technology and consultative advice to organisations looking to raise more at events and online. 2020 is a very special year for us, and we are celebrating 10 years since we started supporting charities, and we have helped to raise over $550 million across the US, Canada, UK, Hong Kong and Australia. We're excited to share our fundraising best practices, tips and tricks through this medium, so sit back and enjoy the show. Hi, welcome to the Givergy podcast. For those of you who don't know who we are, we're fundraising experts who provide fundraising technology and consultative advice to organisations looking to raise more at events and online. 2020 is a very special year for us as we're celebrating our 10 years since we started, and we've been supporting charities, and we've now helped to raise over $550 million to date. We're excited to share our fundraising best practices, tips and tricks through this medium, so sit back and enjoy the show. We are actually here in Sydney, Australia for our Future of Fundraising tour, which brings me to this week's very, very special guest, which is Stephen Malley, a fundraising expert and advisor based here in Australia. We've invited Stephen to share his top five mistakes that event fundraisers can make when planning an event. But before that, let's find out a little bit about Stephen. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for joining us. So, Stephen, tell us a little bit about, you know, how did you get into this?
Into fundraising?
Yeah.
Well, I've been at this for a while now. In fact, since I graduated from the University of Wisconsin in the mid-80s. Which really dates me, but I oftentimes say that I don't think any of us in that day and age believed that we would ever go into fundraising. We sort of fell into it. And, you know, there weren't programs at universities the way there are today that focus on nonprofit leadership, management, fundraising. There weren't any sort of training programs. So most of us sort of fell into fundraising and learned by doing. We learned by our successes and certainly learned from our mistakes. I graduated from the University of Wisconsin, as I said, in the mid-80s, and unemployment was very high at that point in time. And I ended up taking a job for an organization that deals with people living with disabilities, and I was running a funds. I was running events at that point in time, and it was a job that I could land during that period of unemployment, and I was lucky to land into a field that I actually love and have been in all that time. I feel very lucky to do a job that allows me to contribute back to society and to some terrific organizations that I care deeply about.
Love it. So how did you make it here to Australia? Because obviously you're from the US.
Yes, that's right. You can probably tell by my accent, right? I was a fundraiser for many years and also used a piece of technology and ended up going to work for that technology company in the US. And that company happens to have an office here in Sydney. And one night I got a call asking me whether or not I'd be interested in relocating to Sydney after having worked for them for about 18 months in the US. And not a call that I expected to get that day and not something that you say yes or no to right away. So I came here to Australia to sort of check it out for a couple of weeks and went back to my home in Boston and decided that it was the right thing to do. And I came over on what was supposed to be a 2-year work visa. And here I am 12 years later and now a citizen of both Australia and the US, and I have my own company as of 5 years ago.
Brilliant. And do you love it here in Australia now?
I do. You know, it's a very easy country for an American to live in because it's quite similar to America. It's a bit of a blend, I guess, of the UK and North America, but it's a very easy city to live in. I think you've got to make some adjustments, particularly around fundraising, because we're very aggressive in North America. And so you've got to sometimes tone things down, yeah. But it's an easy culture to be a part of. The people are amazing. The weather is nothing to frown on, and at least most of the year. And it's a very enjoyable city to live in and country to be a part of.
Yeah, and I have to agree. So what do you actually offer to charities here in Australia?
Yeah, so the company is called Fundraising Force, and we're quite generalist in our offerings. You know, we provide fundraising strategic planning services. So we'll help an organization to create a 3-year roadmap on their focus areas and their objectives to help them to achieve their goals. We also help them to implement those plans. So oftentimes an organization is very limited on their staff size. So we're there to and available to them to help them to implement any part of their fundraising strat plan. We also do mystery shopping. So we provide mystery shoppers to monitor their face-to-face solicitors or canvassers out on the street or in shopping centers and other public locations. We have provided focus groups for charitable organizations who are wondering how something might play in terms of a strategy or creative billboards, things like that. We provide focus groups for that sort of thing. We provide CRM searches, so constituent relationship management systems are plentiful in a market like this. And so we help organizations to gather their functional requirements and to send those out to the marketplace, run their demonstrations and things like that. We also provide project management to help them implement their CRMs and a host of other services. So as I say, we're quite general in our services. And that's the great thing about working in this sector. We can be, and it's a great variety for us. It makes work exciting.
Absolutely. And it's very wide-ranging, all the different services you offer. Do you offer it just to Australia or is it any other countries?
We do work throughout Europe and also here in Asia Pacific. So, you know, we span over to New Zealand throughout Asia. And then, as I said, throughout Europe, we don't currently work in North America, but it's not to suggest that we wouldn't. We just, our time tends to be spent over there with family and friends and doing personal activities as opposed to actually doing work in North America.
Understood. And just a bit of advice for fundraisers. Mm-hmm. What would you say is the biggest challenge that fundraisers here in Australia or worldwide are facing right now?
Well, I think the uncertainty of the economic times is challenging for organizations. Right now we're facing the coronavirus. So, you know, who knows what that's going to do to us economically as well as work-wise. We, in this country, we don't know if we're going to go into lockdown. You know, who knows what the coming 2 to 3 weeks are going to be like, but I think soon we'll know the outcome of that. You know, put those things aside, you know, we've got a election coming up in the U.S. and at least here in Australia, whenever there's an election, there's great uncertainty about what that's going to do to the markets and what have you. I think, you know, more specifically for charitable organizations, though, the challenge is always budget and convincing leadership to do the things that you and I believe on the front lines ought to be done. And, you know, given the uncertain times right now, that's an even bigger challenge for nonprofit leaders, is to convince those powers that be that it's still okay to keep investing and moving in the right direction, even though times might be a bit uncertain.
Absolutely. Persevere. So we'll move on to our main topics, which is the top 5 mistakes that fundraisers can make around event fundraising. So the first one that we're going to talk around is not being direct in asking people to donate. Do you want to expand on that?
Sure. Well, I'm saying this as an aggressive American, and I'm, you know, I give myself that label, but I think as American fundraisers, we are far more aggressive in our asking and, you know, relationship building than other pockets of the world. And I'm not ashamed of that. In fact, I would like to see fundraisers in Asia Pacific and, you know, Europe, elsewhere in the world, adopt a more aggressive stance. I think that oftentimes we leave too much money on the table, and we have to remember that we've got a lot of competition out there for the dollar, the pound, whatever the currency might be where your listeners reside. We've got a lot of competition. And so if we're not making the ask, our competition is. And so if your charitable organization is not in my letterbox tonight or not in my inbox today, somebody else is. And they might be more creative in their asking, what have you, and they're going to get my attention and get the donor's attention over remembering an organization that is too shy to make that ask. I also think that we oftentimes don't involve enough people in our organization in making that ask. And so we can do a better job at building coalitions across our organization, whether they're other staff people, volunteers, board members, our peers that work in other departments within our charities to help us to make that ask, build an army around you.
Absolutely. And you know, we're here at the Future Fundraising in Australia. We've just, delivered the event. And one of the fundraisers commented to say that, she feels that people just coming to her charity gala dinner, that ticket price is probably, is probably enough. And you could tell that she was really worried about actually asking for more. Mm-hmm. What do you say about that, for fundraisers that are feeling that way?
Well, I think those are her thoughts and feelings. Now, they might be well warranted. I don't want to discount somebody's direct opinion about their organization. You and I don't know her organization well. And, that may be very real. That may be factual. The worry that I have is that we sometimes believe things that aren't factual. Mm-hmm. And I encourage her and others who have that feeling that the $200 ticket price is all somebody can bear, or, maybe they'll buy a raffle ticket at the event at, $5, but that's the extent of what their giving will be. I think we oftentimes need to test and push the envelope as far as we can push it. Here in Australia, most nonprofit organizations would only solicit their constituencies 4 times a year. And when you ask them why they only ask 4 times a year, they would say, because we always have. And that sort of mentality drives me crazy, because I want them to ask a 5th time. Mm-hmm. And if that's successful, I want them to ask a 6th time. I think that we just don't ask enough. And we have these notions that may not be factual because we haven't gone out to test it. And so therefore, I really appreciated the comment that she made, and I can sympathize with her, but I also wonder if it's fully factual. And, we did encourage her to test and push that envelope. And I think more people need to push the envelope as far as they possibly can without offending or turning people off. And that's that fine line that we walk.
Yeah. Well, actually, it sounds like the story that I'm sure our listeners would like to hear about. When you worked at the hospital?
Yes.
And you decided to do a mail out in January?
Yes, that's right. So in the U.S., your U.S. listeners will know this well, the tax year is December 31st. It ends on December 31st, and it's no secret that, 6 days earlier, the largest Christian holiday exists as in Christmas. And so people have just been faced with gift giving and, big holiday celebration with food and family. And now they've got to pay a tax bill. So January is a very cash poor time for most Americans. And most charitable organizations wouldn't think to send out an appeal in the month of January. So I got an idea that it would be pretty unique to make a major ask in the month of January, because nobody else is doing it, so the competition would be slim. And because the Christmas appeal, normally drops sort of beginning of November, we happen to call it year-end appeal to be sensitive to other religions. Because that drops the early part of November, there's an ample opportunity to do a follow-up in January.
Okay.
So at the hospital, we created a piece that I had hoped would get opened once it was removed from the letterbox. And the way that we created the creative was to put on the outside of the envelope original letter mailed, and we named the date in November that the original letter had been mailed. The hospital return address was there, and of course the addressee and their contact details. We sent that out, and a few days after that particular letter had dropped, the CEO of the hospital rang my office, and he said, "Stephen, get in my office immediately." And by his tone of his voice, I knew I probably wasn't going to be promoted to another job. And so I walked across the street to his office and walked in and, you know, said, "You wanted to see me." The CEO is a physician also at the hospital. And he said to me, "What have you done?" And he threw three copies of the letter down on the table in his office. And I said, "Oh, well, this is the follow-up appeal to our Christmas appeal." And I was very proud of it. And judging from his tone, this conversation was going to go in another direction. He then told me that he had received a few complaints on his walk into the hospital that morning. I asked him from whom. And he said three nurses had received it in their letterbox the day before and were quite offended by the piece. I asked him why, and he said, "Because to them, it appears as though it's a bill." And I said to him, "Fantastic, that's exactly what I wanted." Mm-hmm. And he said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "In direct marketing, our number one challenge is getting the piece delivered, whether it's an accurate email address in these days, and certainly in those days, you know, an accurate postal address. And after it gets delivered, our second biggest challenge is getting the device opened."
Yeah.
Today, whether, you know, you and I just go through and delete emails that we receive on a daily basis, or in that case, getting the letter opened as opposed to having it land in the rubbish or in the recycling bin. And so we had a somewhat challenging conversation, and he told me if I ever did that again, he would fire me. And I thanked him for his time and left and went back to him 30, 60, and 90 days later with some fantastic statistics in that this was our largest appeal ever. And here it was a follow-up appeal. It was the largest in terms of the number of donors and most money raised. And so the following year, I repeated it. I repeated it the year after that. And I'm proud to say that up until including this year, they have repeated the appeal. I know that because I'm on the mailing list, and it has turned out to be the most successful appeal year after year after year. So I guess the moral of the story is, you know, don't always go with your gut and don't listen to your colleagues as the sole advice that you get. I'm not suggesting that we ignore the opinions of our work colleagues, but at the end of the day, remember, it's the external audience that we really need to care about.
It's great advice. Okay, so let's move on to point number two, which is little or no investment in the infrastructure.
Yeah, so, you know, I think in not-for-profit organizations, universities, schools, you name the type of the organization, we oftentimes cut corners. And we oftentimes try to get by with as little investment as possible in our organizations because, you know, the bulk of the dollar, the pound, whatever the currency is, needs to go to services or delivery of mission. I get that. But sometimes that's at a cost. And so organizations out there that lack a CRM, they lack a good database solution, organizations out there that could use other pieces of technology oftentimes try to get by without it. And that impacts our overall fundraising, impacts our capacity to raise money, attract more donors, retain donors. And that's a real challenge for us because it is, you know, what we might say penny wise and pound foolish. And so I encourage organizations to invest in technology and to view it not as an expense, but as an investment that's going to pay off down the road and use that technology, push it to its fullest extent and to ensure that it is helping to deliver more on the fundraising side and retain more donors, acquire more donors, and report back to leadership that those dollars that they did ultimately approve in terms of the spend has actually been a wise investment, and here's proof to show it. It's all in the data.
Yeah. And you know what? We can relate to it. A Givergy, because obviously we're a technology provider.
That's right.
And the amount of charities that I've met over the years that are, for example, doing paper bidding, and they're there with the board and they're trying to convince them constantly to go, you know, we really should try mobile bidding or tablet bidding. And it can take them sometimes a couple of years just to get the board to be convinced that mm-hmm. making that investment actually could raise you more. Mm-hmm. The same as a CRM.
And there's a reputation cost as well. So let's just use that example, having run events with auctions. Mm-hmm. The queue goes out the door at the end of the night and you upset people because your paper bid sheets have to be collated and, you know, you want people to give their credit card at the end of the night and take those items. You don't want to lug them back to the office on Monday morning. So I think, you know, we've got to think about the reputation cost also in terms of organization and how it looked and felt at the end of the night, because that's what people remember when they go home. It's not so much the dessert that they had or how great the wine was. It's what was that experience departing the event when they wanted to get home to the kids and release the babysitter, etc.
Okay. And the third point is transaction versus relationship.
Mm. So 8 years ago in Australia, I started a mystery shopping study where I gave to 100 not-for-profit organizations, and I only gave $20, but I thought that was a healthy-sized donation just to measure a few things. And so I measured the gift-giving experience, whether it was on the telephone, on the website, or mm-hmm. through a letter. And I measured whether or not the charitable organization chose to thank me. And if they did thank me, how many days, weeks, months did it take to receive that thank you letter or receipt? And then the accuracy of that information. Did they spell my name correct? Did they get the donation amount correct? Things like that. And finally, I measured all of the follow-on stewardship materials that they sent, as well as how many asks that they made of me throughout the course of the year, what those dollar values were when they did make an ask of me, and things like that. The findings are startling, and I've written about this in some publications, and I've spoken about this at conferences. I guess the message here is that when somebody gives, or whether they give $20 or they give $20,000, it's not a transaction. They're trying to have a relationship with you. And too many times we treat $20 donors as though it's just a transaction. Mm-hmm. I send the charity a donation. They send me a receipt pack. Next step is that they ask me for more. They might ask me for an additional donation, or they might ask me for a regular gift, a monthly donation, things like that. So it's transaction back and forth rather than relationship building. And I think the other message I have here is oftentimes we treat our event donors with less respect than we treat a major donor. And in my opinion, somebody who buys a table at an event or gets 9 of their friends, family members to join them in purchasing a table at an event is just as valuable as an outright major donor. Somebody who does peer-to-peer fundraising, and so they host a barbecue in their backyard or they participate in a marathon in your city, is just as significant as a major donor. And I say that because they are engaging multiple people to join their effort and support their effort. They come out and cheer them. They're engaging people who would otherwise not be engaged in your not-for-profit organization. And they're also raising as much money as a major gift. So we need to treat these people with the same level of respect as we do an outright major donor.
Okay. And how do you think, you know, for charities, you know, lots of people listening to this, it's always about resource. And even, you know, the last few days that we've been doing this tour, mm-hmm. you can tell that a lot of small to medium charities really struggle with that because of mm-hmm. just not physically having the time. Mm-hmm. Is there any advice that you can give to fundraisers that are struggling with that and they want to communicate out?
Yeah, I think sometimes we think that we're busier than we are. I think sometimes we talk about how busy we are more than we focus on the tasks at hand. And I think sometimes we don't organize ourselves in a fashion so that we can get more done in a day. Now, I'm a bit of a workaholic, and I admit that. Not everybody wants to work around the clock or has the motivations. I own my own business, so I need to invest that kind of time. Not everybody does that, and lots of people have families and personal lives that they want to attend to, and they have a better work-life balance than I do. That said, I think sometimes we convince ourselves that we don't have the resources, whether it's budgetary resources or time, to get those things done. And I'd like to suggest that we talk less about it so that we don't keep reinforcing that mindset and instead are motivated getting the job done and pushing forward. You know, success breeds success. And we really need some wins on the board in order to convince leadership and the board to give us more money to invest more in our fundraising programs.
Very true. So point four is a fear of complaints.
Ah, so this one is a bit of a pet peeve for me in that I think oftentimes we view complaints as a really bad thing. I believe a complaint is a fantastic thing because it gives you information to act on. I would rather hear a complaint or constructive feedback than to have people out there whispering about it and I am unable to act on it. And so I suggest to clients and, you know, certainly your listeners that we think about who are the appropriate people in our organization who can speak to folks who want to offer us that constructive feedback. And how can we turn that negative into a positive? And, you know, some perfect examples are anybody who calls a not-for-profit organization to say, I'm tired of receiving your mail or your email. I want to opt out. Why can't we turn that around and not lose them? Don't automatically agree to remove them from the database, but talk to them about our capacity to perhaps reduce the number of pieces that they receive in the mail or in their inbox and turn that negative into a positive so that we don't lose them. They've been valuable supporters of our organizations for years and have been engaged. We've just done something to perhaps push them a bit too far, but we can turn that negative into a positive. I don't know that unless they ring the office. So we've got to make sure that the right people are answering the phone, if they send a complaint email, that we take the time to respond to them in a more personal channel. So call them as opposed to just responding to that email and never ignore those complaints. Too many organizations kind of put them aside and they think, oh, those are the negative folks and they don't want to have anything to do with us anymore. When in fact, they probably do if they're approached the right way.
Yeah, I can imagine. And what about, you know, the big thing that's I think, you know, you've spoken about over the last couple of days is social media. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone, you do a campaign or you put a post up and then someone drops a negative comment. Mm-hmm. How do you think people should react to that?
Well, we've got to have people who monitor those channels. And, you know, not every not-for-profit organization can afford social listening software. So it's a job. We've got to monitor those social media channels and make sure that we are engaging with people who do post a complaint or a compliment. And we're great at posting to social media. And, you know, most of us post in Australia at 10 a.m. throughout Monday through Friday, because that's when those posts get looked at by folks who follow us. But at the end of the day, we're not so great at monitoring the comments, particularly comments that come in after hours. And it blows my mind when I see negative comments about some of the art unions, you know, the car draws, the house draws, speculation that, you know, the winners aren't real or that the prizes are never given. That's the kind of feedback that we need to respond to so that it doesn't become infectious and people believe that, you know, these charitable organizations never give away those $2 million homes or those, you know, expensive Mercedes, BMWs, what have you. And that's just one example, but I've seen some pretty nasty language on Facebook and and other social media channels about these sort of activities, and they go unresponded to, when in fact, I think there's a way to handle that. We don't want to delete that. That looks like we're hiding something, but I think there's an opportunity for us after hours to monitor those channels and to respond accordingly.
And from your experience, would your advice be to reply on the post or direct message?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I do think you want to reply on the post so that others who have read it or might read it coming up will have an opportunity to see what the facts are. Yeah. But I also think if you know the person and they're part of your CRM, that there's an opportunity to respond to them personally as well.
And I suppose, like you said earlier, it's give them a ring, you know, rather than just going straight back with a message, getting on the phone, having a chat and trying to
absolutely
win them back over sort of thing.
You know, I think at the end of the day, this is not something that becomes somebody's full-time job, and there aren't members of the general public, for the most part, are not out there posting in a negative fashion on a charitable organization's Facebook page, on Twitter, what have you. But there are some poisonous people in society, and my suggestion is nip it in the bud. I wouldn't want to see it turn into a debate.
Yeah.
You know, this is not about a political stance or something of that sort, the way we see it on Twitter. But I think there's an opportunity for us to turn a negative person around on social media as well.
Yeah, totally agree. So our fifth and final point is doing the same thing.
So this is all about innovation, in my opinion. So charitable organizations, like people in their personal lives and certainly companies out there, are creatures of habit. And if something works, we do it over and over and over again and expect that it's always going to work. And likewise, if something fails, we cut it out the next year. And my suggestion with this one is, why not tweak it, whether it worked or failed, and give it another try? And also, we have to innovate. We've got to constantly try to stay ahead of ourselves and innovate in such a way that we keep the event or we keep the direct marketing piece, whatever it is, we keep it fresh. You know, major gift staff need to keep their approaches fresh. Bequest staff need to keep their marketing fresh. And the same is true with our events. You know, an event might be successful 2-3 years in a row, but it's not always going to be that way. So there's a real need to innovate and bring new approaches to the event. One of the great things that I've been impressed with this week in Australia with Givergy is the fact that you seem to be innovating in the technology. You're listening to customers and developing the technology to keep it fresh. Yeah, there's stuff that works really well in it. But if you rest on that, you've got competitors just like I do in my business. And what works this year is not necessarily going to work 5 years from now. So you're keeping your technology innovative. Your customers need to keep their events and other approaches fresh and innovative, because there's a lot of competition for all of us out there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing just on that, you know, working the amount of events that I've personally been at over the years, I think a lot of charity fundraisers are scared to try new things. Mm. And I'll sometimes consult or spend time with the charity and I'll be like, let's really try and push the pledge. And they'll be like, but no, I know my donors and also all the board. And it can take them so long to just move that concept forward. Mm. And recently we've had some really good wins where charities are now trying new ideas for their event. Mm. But we still see so many charities that are so fearful of like you said, it's worked for me every year. It's always done around the kind of same amount. And we're like, no, come on, just really, really take a risk and kind of push and try a new thing. You know, have you got any advice for board members? Because I think sometimes that can be the biggest pushback, is they won't move forward.
Well, this is probably not going to be very settling to some of your listeners, but I would question why the board is involved in that level of detail to begin with.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I get that small organizations, the board is more involved than, say, a larger charitable organization, but the board is meant to be there for governance and, you know, escalation points and what have you. So I would just question why the board is involved in that level of detail with a single event. And I think that there's an opportunity to for leadership of the organization, which includes the fundraising leadership, mm-hmm. to work with the board to take them to a higher level and give them activities that are at that higher level so that you can make the decisions that need to be made, such as what technology to use and, you know, what sort of innovative aspects or twists that you're going to add to the event. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there's plenty of opportunity to be what I call a Monday morning quarterback, which is, you know, analyze, review, analyze, and, you know, evaluate an event. And board members are just as important in terms of their opinion as the average attendee. So the board members will be able to give that feedback, but I actually think that it's worth working with the board to take them out of that level of detail so that the fundraiser can manage the event.
Get it. Brill, well, that's all of our 5 points. So thank you so much, Stephen, for joining us today.
Thank you.
I know that our listeners will have thoroughly enjoyed the advice that you've been able to give. And if you would like to find out more about Stephen and his company, Fundraising Force, visit www.fundraisingforce.com.au. You'll find out so many great tips on the blog page, and you can reach out to him personally to hear more about his services. We really hope that you've enjoyed today's episode and found the content informative. We would love to hear your thoughts, so please feel free to email us at podcast@giveagy.com, and you can also make suggestions of future topics or guests you would love to hear on the show. Thanks again, and don't forget to hit subscribe or follow to listen. And look out for our next episode, which will focus on data and how to get the most out of your event. Thank you.